All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show.
Hi, this is Nick Freitas with Making the Argument, and today we're going to be talking about the conservative approach to law enforcement and criminal justice reform. We're going to be going over some personal stories that I have from actually growing up in a law enforcement family with my father serving with the LAPD for many years. We're going to talk about the various policies that we can implement from a legislative perspective in order to improve the quality of law enforcement services that communities receive. We're also going to be talking about the concept of community policing, what it means and why don't we have more of it. And then finally, we're going to be sharing some stories about the positive effects that community policing can have, all coming up on Making the Argument.
Because one thing I've learned is this, in politics and in combat, cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. And if you're willing to be the first person over those ramparts, you will be shocked at how many people will come with you. I'm asking you to come with me. I'm asking you to be a part of the generation that will restore the promise of this country and breathe new life into it.
My dad was an LAPD police officer, and as a little boy, if you knew me for more than 5 seconds, you would have known that fact. I loved telling people about my dad, the cop. And my dad had a great career with LAPD. He served as a patrol officer for about 10 to 11 years, served as a detective, then a homicide detective. Then he was moved to Robbery Homicide Division, which if you know anything about the LAPD, it's really one of the pinnacle locations for detectives. He served 20 years. He actually had a massive stroke on the job at 39 and had to medically retire far sooner. I guarantee you, if he hadn't had to retire then, he would still be on the job. He absolutely loved being a police officer. And as a young boy, I loved hearing the stories. I loved meeting his friends and his the partners that he had. It's funny now when I'll watch a TV show like Bosch. It's guys I know that were either partners of my dad or work with my dad who have these cameo appearances within the show or who had served as technical advisors. The bottom line is that I have grown up with an incredible respect for law enforcement and our men and women that wear blue. And it's not because I don't understand that there are cops out there that do the wrong thing. It's more of the fact that I was surrounded by so many of them that I knew personally, and I saw what they went through, and I saw what families went through. My dad used to tell me stories about times where, you know, officers would have to go serve warrants and literally get in head-to-toe body armor because as soon as they knocked on the door and said, "Police, we have a warrant," bullets would come flying through the door. And they'd be put in danger. You know, obviously their wife, their kids are wondering, are they going to come home safe at night? And so understand that that's the background that I'm coming from whenever we talk about law enforcement reform, criminal justice reform. It really does come from this place of respect and understanding, at least from the perspective of being the child of a police officer, of everything that they go through. And having a little bit of experience on dealing with violent situations, having been a soldier, having been a Green Beret, having been to combat, I'm also very sympathetic to the fact that while everything always plays out well in the movies, and while the media always think that they know what the right course of action would have been, when you really are in that moment of danger and the next decision you're going to make is not only going to affect the outcome of your life, but the life of a friend, a partner, a community member, the innocent person that you're trying to protect, that is a stressful situation. And so I do think that there's a certain degree of grace that is owed. I mean, obviously, we always need to be looking for the best standards possible. But at the same time, remember that the men and women that put on the uniform, they're men and women. They're not perfect. Yes, they've been trained. Yes, they're trying to do the right thing. But when we can actually come up with solutions, both from a policy side as well as community-oriented solutions that make it easier for law enforcement to do their job and focus their intention on really what it is that most of them joined up to do in the first place, protect their communities and make them safe. So let's go through some of the policy decisions that we've been hearing a lot about ever since before the protest started with George Floyd, but have really kind of captured the news and the talking points that a lot of politicians are put forward. And I think what we'll see through all of these is there's some good, there's some bad, and there's some probably need a little bit more thinking before they actually get implemented. So let's go into policies next. So as we talk about potential legislation or policy, I think the first thing that we have to address is that the idea that politics can solve all of this is pretty absurd. Yes, there's various things that we can do from a legislative perspective that could potentially improve outcomes, but we shouldn't put too much faith in it, because one of the things I'd like to point out is that we're in this position that we're in right now with the, you know, general mistrust that we're seeing among some members of the community and law enforcement because of government involvement. And I would say government overreaction or an attempt to micromanage society in general. There's a great book that was put out called Three Felonies a Day. And the whole premise of the book is that the average, you know, well-meaning citizen could commit up to three felonies a day between state, local, federal laws without even knowing that they had done so, with no intention of breaking the law, and without creating a single victim in the process. This is what happens when you have over-criminalization and essentially just too many laws on the books. So one of the things I like to remind legislators and politicians in general is that every time you put forward a bill to be signed into law, that adds some sort of new tax, fee, fine, regulation, rule, whatever it is, you are essentially saying, I want the government to potentially use physical force to ensure that this idea is implemented. Now, I think it's a reasonable question to say that if this idea is so good, why do you got to coerce people to do it? I mean, I understand why we need laws for things like preventing, you know, murder or burglary or theft or rape or assault or battery. Sure, those are appropriate situations for the government to show up and potentially show up and have to use violence in order to protect innocent people from being harmed. My problem is when politicians have all kinds of grandiose notions for how they're going to reorganize society in order to make it better and create a bunch of laws in the process. Because when men and women in blue, when police officers, when sheriff's deputies have to go out and actually enforce those laws and it goes bad, do you ever see any of those politicians stepping forward and saying, you know what, we made a mistake. Maybe this doesn't rise to level of importance as to wanting law enforcement to go out and use physical force against our constituents in order to impose it. No, they never say that, right? Because they've always got this idea that whenever they sign a law, or whenever they submit a bill, or whenever it's signed into law, it's only going to be implemented in accordance with their intentions. Well, that's not how laws work. Laws are interpreted in accordance with the language that you use, and people respond differently to the incentives that you create. And unfortunately, there's a lot of laws out there that have a lot of perverse incentives, but you never see politicians actually taking responsibility for their actions. You always see them throwing the police under the bus when the police implemented or enforced a law they helped write and create. So, first thing to remember, politicians out there, law enforcement live at the business end of every stupid idea that you actually put into effect into law. So let's be a little bit more, humble. Let's display a little bit of more humility with respect to what we decide to try to impose through the threat of violence and coercion. So first things first, we need to go through and actually look at a lot of the laws, taxes, fees, fines, regulations we have on the books in order to determine that, is there too much here? I guarantee you there is. And we already see some people that are putting forward legislation that I think will do a great job of actually identifying what laws are on the books, how often are they enforced, you know, how does the enforcement actually play out in real life, what sort of interactions between law enforcement and citizens do we see taking place as a result of these laws. Because once we can better identify that, we can do a better data-driven response in order to determine whether or not they're appropriate or if it's something that we should get rid of. So, working to getting rid of bad laws and the over-criminalization that happens as a result, it should be one of our top priorities from the legislature. Some of the other things we need to work on are things like policing for profit. So, for instance, in Virginia, when state troopers pull you over and they give you a speeding ticket, a lot of people assume that that money goes right to the state troopers. It actually doesn't. It goes to the literacy fund. And the reason why it goes to a separate fund is because we don't want to encourage what they commonly refer to as policing for profit, which is to say that the more tickets you write, the more revenue you generate for your department, right? The ultimate goal for our law enforcement should be about protecting society, not enforcing laws for the express permission of being able to increase their budgets. Another bill that I actually carried for 3 years, we finally got passed in Virginia this last year, had to do with civil asset forfeiture reform. Now, what most people don't understand is that the government actually has the authority to confiscate your property and sell it in order to put it into their own budget, having never convicted you of a crime. Let me give you an example of this. Let's say you loan your car over to your cousin who's trying to get a job, or at least he tells you he's going for a job interview. Next thing you know, you get a call from the police informing you that your cousin was pulled over in your vehicle when he was hauling a couple pounds of heroin to a drug deal. Now, they're going to arrest your cousin. They're going to take the heroin. You probably are fine with all of that. But what they can also do is now confiscate your vehicle, and since they can prove that your vehicle was used in a criminal act, they can now forfeit it, sell it, and put it into their budget. That's the part where I think it gets a little bit unfair. Now, had the cousin been driving his own car and that car had been used in criminal activity, that's fine. That's what we call criminal asset forfeiture. But the difference between criminal asset forfeiture and civil asset forfeiture is that in criminal asset forfeiture, someone has to actually be committed or convicted of a crime, and there has to be clear evidence demonstrating that they use certain items, like perhaps a laptop or a firearm or their vehicle, in the commission of a crime in order for it to be confiscated and eventually sold by the police. In civil asset forfeiture, they just got to prove it was used for a criminal purpose, even if you had no idea it was being used for that purpose. And so one of the things that we've been working on is moving from civil asset forfeiture to criminal asset forfeiture. Another thing that we need to focus on within our criminal justice system is restitution to victims. One of the things that's been really frustrating to me is that if you're the victim of a crime and the police catch the person who stole from you or robbed you or hurt you, and they get convicted, when they go to jail, when they're working off, they first have to pay their court fees before they ever have to pay anything to you as their victim. So even if you were awarded restitution, they can be released from jail having served their time and never have to pay you back. There may be, you know, some restrictions on them, but ultimately they have to prioritize paying back the government before they pay back you. And I think that's wrong. It puts the entire apparatus in a bad disposition. The whole point of criminal justice reform should be about ensuring that victims are made whole. That our first goal is to make sure they never become victims in the first place. If they do, it's to protect them and make sure that they get justice. And part of that justice has to do with financial restitution. And that should be our first priority. Before we ever require them to pay back the court or anything else, they should have to pay back their victim. And I think this is important for a couple of reasons. One, it puts our justice system in the right disposition. Two, it actually creates a scenario where the money that person has to pay back is directly to their victim. So there's some sort of connection between them and the person that they actually victimized. Three, I think it does a better job ultimately when someone leaves custody having served their time, if they still have to be able to pay that restitution. Again, it puts them in the proper perspective with respect to why they were being punished in the first place. They weren't being punished because they violated the law. They weren't being punished just because they did something the government told them not to do. They were being punished because they hurt a fellow citizen. And we need to have the proper perspective, and we should make sure that the people serving have the proper perspective. Another thing that we can talk about is qualified immunity. Qualified immunity is one of these policies that was implemented earlier in the 20th century for the purpose of preventing law enforcement officers from getting, you know, caught up in frivolous lawsuits. So I think all of us can imagine, you know, a bad attorney that's just trying to make a buck that is constantly suing the police. So let's say you're walking down the street, the police stop you and check your ID because you match the description of a suspect. Well, now all of a sudden a lawyer runs up and says, hey, we can sue the police for unlawful detention because they kept you there, right? That's the sort of thing that we're trying to avoid. And I think most of us agree with that. Unfortunately, qualified immunity has been so loosely interpreted that it has has actually protected bad actors within the police department. And so I think you see widespread support both within law enforcement and outside of law enforcement in order to more clearly define qualified immunity. So it does provide the necessary protections that we're looking for in protection against frivolous lawsuits, but it doesn't create a scenario where somebody that is clearly violating your constitutional rights, that is clearly violating you, gets away with it simply because they happen to be a police officer or some other agent of the government. And there's a number of other policies too that we can talk about. There's everything from discussion about reform for no-knock warrants, body cameras. You know, all of these different discussions have merit and are something that we should go through and look at carefully in order to ensure that we are getting the right kind of outcomes. One of the things I cannot stand is a politician that thinks that their legislation is always going to be followed or interpreted in accordance with their intentions. It is very, very careful or very, very important that we create legislation that not only has good intentions, but creates the proper incentive structure so that we know it will be implemented as close to the intentions as humanly possible. The final concept I want to go over today has to do with community policing, and this really deserves its own discussion. So we're going to talk about what community policing is, why it is that pretty much everyone across the board agrees that it's a good idea, and then ask the question, if everyone agrees it's a good idea, why don't we have more of it? Community policing, roughly defined, is a process whereby the community and law enforcement have a close working relationship with one another in order to identify and prioritize community concerns. A lot of the features of community and policing include things like law enforcement officers being able to work in the same area with the same people for multiple years in order to build the sort of rapport that is necessary to foster a good working relationship. Almost everyone you talk to, especially in law enforcement, loves the idea of community policing because it really does change the dynamic to where the community is now a partner in this. It's not us and them between the community and law enforcement, but rather it's all us. Law enforcement come from that community and they're there to help protect that community. One of the reasons why we don't have the sort of community policing that we would like to see more of in this country actually has to do with federal overreach. What a shocker. So starting in the 1920s, when the federal government was trying to impose prohibition, which was the basically making the sale of alcohol illegal or hard liquor illegal, they were frustrated because they didn't have enough federal law enforcement resources to actually enforce that law. And so they were constantly trying to co-opt local law enforcement to assist with the enforcement of these federal laws. Now, here's what you need to understand. You're a local sheriff in rural Virginia, and you're chasing after somebody that robbed somebody. You're chasing after maybe somebody that committed a violent crime, somebody that maybe had murdered someone, and you've got limited assets. What are you going to focus your resources on? You're going to go after the murderer, or are you going to go after the moonshiner that you've known for 40 years and that you really don't have any problem with? You're probably going to go after the murderer. Well, the federal government doesn't actually prosecute local murders like that. It's not a priority for the federal government. But the federal government did enforce the 18th Amendment and go after prohibition and alcohol sales. So they started offering more plans to consolidate law enforcement because it was easier for the federal government to then add grant funding and other funding mechanisms in order to reprioritize federal concerns over local concerns. Now, this started in the 1920s, but we really started to see the consolidation effort pick up a lot of steam in the late 60s, early 70s, where they would actually diminish or get rid of some of these smaller departments and consolidate them into larger metropolitan departments. Now, the justification that was used for consolidation was that it would create efficiency, it would remove redundancies, and that it would be overall easier from a command and control perspective. And there's some argument to be made for limited means of consolidation. The problem was is that along with this consolidation movement, they were actually encouraging officers to serve into communities that they weren't as familiar with. When you were taking multiple small departments and putting them all into one major department and then shifting officers around, well, obviously you're going to create a scenario where an officer is not familiar with the environment that they're working in. In addition to that, you also saw, once again, the federal government coming in and prioritizing federal concerns over local concerns. And because the federal government had money to give away, it actually incentivized local law enforcement to join these federal task force, which included pulling police officers off of the communities they were serving in order to serve in these task force for some specific purpose, inevitably tied to federal dollars and a federal concern. Again, the whole concept of community policing is community concerns first. But in this consolidation movement, we saw a lot more interaction between local law enforcement and the federal government. Now, I'm not saying that all of that interaction or cooperation is inappropriate or isn't a good idea at times, but it really should remain, the community really needs to remain the primary focus of local law enforcement. Now, it started to come out, and I really give a lot of credit to Eleanor Ostrom, who was the first female awarded the Nobel Prize for Economics, because she started to do a lot of research on whether or not this top-down consolidation approach was actually working and providing better law enforcement to the communities, and were the communities happier with the sort of law enforcement services that they were getting. And what she found is the answer was no. In fact, it was a complete 180. She found that a lot of smaller departments that were far more community-oriented not only were better at providing for safety and enforcing the law, but did so in a way that the community actually supported. So it was not an us and them relationship. The community felt like their law enforcement agency was there for them, not there to impose rules on them. And that creates a completely different relationship in the mindset of the community. If the community is invested, then now it's a joint venture. They're working together. They provide information to the police. They know who the bad actors are. Because I don't care how many law enforcement officers you have, they're never going to know an individual neighborhood as well as the people living there. And if the people in that neighborhood have a good working relationship with the police, they can give them the necessary information to not only stop crime, but to do it far more effectively and efficiently. Now, when the police go into a situation, they don't have to wonder as much about all the different variables that inevitably go into a law enforcement situation, because they have the connection to the community and they have the local sources that are providing them credible information. Now, is there always going to be certain situations where you might have corruption and you might need an outside party to come and conduct an independent investigation? Of course, nobody's saying that shouldn't exist. But when we want to actually achieve community policing, we need to actually respect a bottom-up approach, not always a top-down one. So the federal government, you know, started to track what Eleanor Ostrom was saying and realized that there was a lot of scientific data to back it. It made sense. And so the federal government came out and said, you know what, maybe we were wrong on all this consolidation process. Maybe we were wrong in prioritizing federal concerns over local ones. We apologize. We're going to back off. Yeah, no, that's not what the federal government said, right? Because that's never what the federal government says, and it's never what federal politicians say. No, the federal government said, you know what? You're right. Community policing is so important that we're going to go ahead and decide what community policing looks like, and then guess what? They're going to give your local police department money, provided that you do community policing in the way that the federal government wants you to do community policing. They have totally missed the point. But again, it's the federal government. Missing the point is part of its charm. No, what we need to do, what we need to achieve, is for the federal government to understand that it does have a proper role in law enforcement, and it should stay within that role. But its job is not to manipulate every state or local agency in order to carry out its own wishes. If it's a legitimate function of federal law enforcement, great. Give the federal law enforcement the resources they need to effectively engage in those law enforcement practices. But law enforcement within a community should be focused on that community. Those communities' priorities should be their top concern. Now, that's also going to include making sure that we properly fund those local departments so they don't feel the need to chase after federal dollars in order to, you know, expand their budgets every time they need another officer or more equipment or new training, right? But we need to understand, and this is a key component of community-based policing, the solutions for a community generally come within that community. That's not to say that there aren't guiding principles which may be universal in nature and can be applied universally in nature. But if we respect that communities are diverse, and therefore the solutions needed will be diverse, and therefore law enforcement roles and responsibilities will in fact be diverse, then we can actually come up with a system that allows each community to be able to sponsor, support, cooperate, and fund law enforcement activities that work best for them. And I want to close with a beautiful example of this, of what happens, what sort of results do you get when you actually allow a police department to do what they want to do anyways, which is prioritize their community and keep it safe. Here in Culpeper County, Virginia, and in the town of Culpeper, we had two protests associated with George Floyd. And both of them ended up being completely peaceful. And I would say that one of the reasons why they were so peaceful, even though they were passionate, one of the reasons why they were so peaceful is I was sitting there observing the protest, and I was observing our law enforcement here, and I watched a woman who was carrying a sign, and she was chanting along with the rest of the protesters, and she looked over, and her eye caught one of the officers. And I saw her put down her sign, run across the street, give him a big hug, take a picture with him, and told him that she cared about him. And then she went back to the protest. And the reason why that happened is they'd gone to high school together. They knew one another. She knew, without a shadow of a doubt, if she called him at 3 o'clock in the morning because she needed help, he would be there and he would do everything to include putting his own life on the line to ensure she was safe. That's community policing. And so to all of our law enforcement officers out there that are fighting hard to keep our communities safe, thank you. To all the people that are working hard to make sure that we can have a good cooperative relationship between our community and our law enforcement agencies, thank you. And to the politicians out there, never forget, law enforcement lives at the business end of everything that you do within the legislature. So be careful that you're not creating the sort of perverse incentives that lead to needless and violent altercations between our citizens and our law enforcement. I'm Nick Freitas with Making the Argument. This has been the conservative approach to law enforcement and criminal justice reform. Thank you for watching. We encourage you to go on. Consider giving us a 5-star rating on our podcast, on Apple Podcasts. Share us on Spotify. Again, one of the best ways that you can get these arguments out to your friends and neighbors is by sharing it. The other thing that we would ask you to do is go onto our YouTube channel and leave some questions for us. Leave some suggestions on what future podcasts you would like to see and what issues you would like us to address. Once again, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.